Hey guys, welcome to the second episode of the Race Car Podcast. If I'm being totally honest, I'm fairly pleased that I got this one turned around in a week. I didn't know how much information there would be out there on the car. It turned out there was actually more than I thought, and the Brabham took me about 3 weeks, I think, to put together, which I guess wasn't even so much that it took me 3 weeks so much as I took 3 weeks to do it, if that makes sense. So I refined my process. I got this one done in a week with, I don't know, probably about the same amount of content, I guess, as I had with the Brabham. So, you know, the Nissan GT-R LM Nismo is what we're talking about today. It was a 2015 Le Mans LMP1 racer, I guess kind of ill-fated, but a really interesting car. I guess I didn't give it enough credit when it first came out, 6 years ago, and I learned a lot about the car. I'm interested in the car. I think it's a pretty cool car to talk about, so It actually worked out much better than I thought it was going to. So, all right, Nissan GT-R LM Nismo, let's go. So I'd say probably a thing about me is I really have a soft spot for race cars that tried to do things. And whether or not the thing that they did worked, it honestly doesn't even matter. So the important thing to me is when somebody looks at the way that race cars are built and just thinks kind of outside of that landscape. And looking at it through that lens, I'd struggle to find another car, or another company even, that thought further outside of that box than Nissan did when they came up with the GT-R LM Nismo. By the time that the car was announced, which is in May 2014, the Formula 4 top-level prototype racing had been set for more or less 50 years. In 1963, Ferrari won Le Mans with the 250P. So in 62, they also won it, but that was with the 330 TRI LM, which was a conventional front-engine rear-drive car. The 250P, on the other hand, put its engine behind the driver, but ahead of the rear axle. So this was the first ever overall victory at Le Mans for a mid-engine, rear-wheel drive prototype race car. In fact, if you want to get an idea of how dominant the mid-engine, rear-wheel drive platform has become, take a look over at Chevrolet, because for 67 years, the Chevrolet Corvette was a front-engined, rear-wheel drive sports car platform, and even they have switched with the Corvette C8 to a mid-engine, rear-wheel drive format. So for a brand like Chevrolet, and especially for a brand like Corvette, for them to look at it and say, you know what, this is the way that we have to go, I realize 50 years after Ferrari, came out with the 250P, it's kind of a big deal when a sort of, I don't really want to call Corvette stodgy, but, that's what they're known for, is being the front-engine, rear-wheel drive sports car. So when they go that route, you know that the gains in going that route must be pretty significant. So there have been a couple of exceptions to this, dominance of the mid-engine, rear-wheel drive platform. Probably the one that most immediately comes to mind would be Panos. They ran the Esperante GTR 1 and then later the LMP 1, which was, if you want to be technical about it, was still a mid-engine setup in that it was a mid-front. So the engine was behind the front axle and ahead of the driver. Technically mid-engine, but not that mid-rear setup that we're all familiar with. They're pretty popular cars. They looked like Batmobiles going around the track, and they sounded like NASCARs. So, and they were somewhat successful. In 1991, the LMP1 won the ALMS championship over BMW, which was pretty cool. As far as, like, world stuff, they did win. They didn't win. They placed fifth at Le Mans twice, which that's a pretty good effort for what was really a much smaller team than the factory efforts at that time. So, I tell you all that to tell you this, which is that Nissan looked at 50 years of proof that mid-engine rear-wheel drive was almost certainly the way to go and had zero interest in going along with that. In fact, it was actually a directive from Nissan to the designer of the car to not just copy Audi. They wanted to win, but they wanted to win their own way. I have a lot of respect for that. There's a lot of guys that we just kind of look at, okay, what works best, and let's just go ahead and do that. And honestly, if you go and you copy Audi, you're hoping to do Audi better than Audi does Audi, which doesn't, at this point, Audi had won, I think, 13 24 Hours of Le Mans. So it seems unlikely that you're going to do better at what they do than they do. was it as unlikely as making a front engine, front wheel drive, 600 horsepower LMP1 work? Well, honestly, who's to say? So Nissan read the rules, and presumably they read them again, and at least once more after that. And Nissan thought that they had found something, which is, in fact, that the aero rules for LMP1 were fairly tight if you're doing a mid-engine rear-wheel drive setup. The way the rules were written, Nissan saw that it was much looser, and they would have a lot more freedom if they built a front-engine car. And so for some reason, Nissan then decided, well, all right, let's just go all in, and they built a front-engine, front-wheel drive LMP1 car. The GTR LM Nismo was designed by Ben Bowlby. If you're aware of Ben Bowlby, you know that he knows a thing or two about weird race cars. He was the designer of the Delta Wing, which was an LMP2 car that was shaped more or less like an F-16 fighter jet. The front track is, I think, like a third the width of the rear track. It's shaped like a dart, but it worked. It didn't get a ton of, it actually got factory support from Nissan, which was cool. But in the LMP2 class that it ran in, it was as quick as the cars it was competing with. It had bad luck. It got taken out of some races. But the design actually showed promise. It actually did what they said that it was going to do, as unlikely as it looked. So really, it should come as no surprise that Ben Bowlby went well outside the box with Nissan on the GTR LM Nismo. So with their front engine, front drive setup, Nissan's philosophy on the car was to generate as much downforce as they possibly could with a minimum of drag, which, when you think about it, it kind of sounds like literally every race car ever built since they introduced downforce onto race cars. But Nissan had a little bit of an unconventional idea with the car. So they decided to build the car with two massive, what they called vacuum tube, air tunnels running down each side of the car all the way to the rear, which would allow the air hitting the front of the car and creating downforce a clear path right through the car rather than evacuating the air around the car, which on its competitors, Audi and Porsche, would usually be right around the front wheels. And the front wheel drive setup of the car is what made this possible. So, and when we say they're massive vacuum tubes, what we mean is apparently they're large enough for the car's chief engineer, Zach Aitken, sent his two-year-old son to crawl through the tubes end to end. So with the setup, Nissan could make huge downforce at the front of the car. They could run a low drag rear wing, and they could release the air coming through the car behind it into a low pressure area, which would create more downforce at the rear of the car. The car was powered by a 3-liter twin turbocharged V6 called the VRX30A, which it's a fairly conventional engine, 4 valves per cylinder, 60-degree banking, dual overhead cams, all that kind of stuff. Nissan would not admit this publicly, but the engine was not actually an in-house design. The engine was actually the work of Cosworth. Some people thought that it might have been a version of the Cosworth F1 engine concept that they had worked on, but it's probably more likely that they just applied some of the lessons learned from that motor to this one. The engine developed, 500-ish horsepower. It had a fairly low red line, 6,500 RPM. It was mated to a 5-speed sequential transmission. They had a pretty broad power band, so 5 gears was actually all that they needed. Interestingly, the way that Nissan actually mounted into the car was they basically set it up like a 1980s or 1990s Saab 900. That is to say, the transmission was up by the nose of the car, and the engine was seated towards the driver. It was actually bolted directly to the monocoque. So because of that setup, Nissan ended up with roughly 65% of the car's weight at the front. So to that end, the car's tires were reverse staggered. The front tires are 14 inches wide. The rears are only 9 inches wide. Nissan reasoned that puts 65% of the car's tire contact patch at the front. Apparently, that was the number that they wanted to work with. The front tires, from a wear standpoint in the race, they figured were good for 2 or 3 fuel stints, while the rears would do 6 to 10, which is pretty impressive tire wear. But then again, if they're just hanging out back there not doing anything, what are you going to do? Like its competitors, Nissan's car was a hybrid. Their choice of hybrid was a mechanical flywheel hybrid. So regenerative braking from the front and rear axles would accelerate 2 16-pound flywheels to 52,000 RPM, and on demand, they would supply an extra 700 horsepower to the car, bring the total horsepower of the vehicle to around 1,200. though the system is classified as a 2 megajoule system. However, unlike Nissan's competitors, their hybrid system was purely mechanical, with no motor generators in the system. The flywheels had an attached transmission, which would send power either to the rear by drive shaft or the front by a shaft running over the top of the engine, because everything else on the car is bananas, so honestly, you know, why wouldn't you do it that way? Interestingly, with the race set to take place in June, by April, Nissan had decided that they weren't going to be able to run the ERS to the rear wheels at all for the race. While they'd made upwards of 1,000 horsepower on the ERS alone, they couldn't get it to deploy reliably to the rear of the car. Like everything else in the car, the ERS was at the front, running it to the rears without disturbing the vacuum tunnels required a system of drive shafts, so Nissan was going to have to carry the whole rear drive system without actually being able to use it. As far as car dynamics go, by all accounts, the car is actually perfectly pleasant to drive. You'd think with all that weight over the front end, the car would plow through turns, but according to Nismo driver Michael Crum, the car was actually very sharp on turn-in and had excellent traction. Because of the front-wheel drive architecture of the car, he said, the drive wheels are pulling the rear, which makes the car inherently stable through acceleration. Nissan believed this would make the car much easier to drive quickly in wet weather and lend the car a lot of predictability in terms of its handling. Aerodynamically, Crum also felt that Nissan had done a good job minimizing drag. He said LMP cars tend to accelerate quickly and then hit a brick wall of drag, but the GTR felt slippery through the air to him. If Nissan had done something very different here, at least they would not have done it at the expense of drivability. The car was meant to debut at Silverstone, but it missed both that race and the preseason test at Paul Ricard because the car failed its crash test twice. On the first test, the car failed because of a roll hoop that was damaged. Ben Bowlby said, quote, it was such a violent failure, it sort of went off like a bomb. The broken roll hoop wasn't the real setback here, though. The big problem was that when the roll hoop broke, it also broke the chassis, which cost $170,000 to replace and 2 months to build another one. Additionally, the car also failed for a door anti-burst load. That is to say, they push outward on the doors, thinking that in the event of an accident, the driver might impact the door and they don't want the door flying open. So the test cracked the door skin, which needed to be redesigned. And because of all these issues, the car's first race, actual performance would be the 24 Hours of Le Mans. Because, you know, who doesn't love showing up to the 24 Hours of Le Mans with literally zero actual race experience? So before we get into the car's performance, I do want to talk a little bit about the competition, because the 2015 season for the WEC was actually shaping up to be pretty interesting in the top-level prototype category. You had four different manufacturers, each with four pretty different looks at this thing, because the WEC regulations at the time allowed quite a lot of interpretation in terms of what you were allowed to do with the engine and the hybrid system. So we had Toyota, Porsche, and kind of returning champion and all-around dominant force in the sport at the time, Audi. And along with Nissan, they all brought really different engine hybrid packages. So Toyota had returned to Le Mans in 2012 for the first time since 99 with the TS030. And they actually ended up finishing second the following year in 2013 after sending two cars there in 2012 and both of them DNF'd. The successor to that car was what they brought out for 2014 and 2015, which is the TS040. It was kind of visually similar to the TS030, but the 040 brought aerodynamic and mechanical upgrades. The biggest of those was a larger engine, which was Toyota was running a naturally aspirated V8, displacing 3.7 liters, making 513 horsepower. Their hybrid system, which was a 6 megajoule class KERS supercapacitor system, supplied an extra 473 horsepower and it would drive both the front and rear wheels. Porsche returned to Le Mans in 2014 with the 919 hybrid. This is actually their first top-level prototype developed and operated entirely in-house since the 911 GT1. Prior to that, there was the LMP2 RS Spyder car, but that was actually developed with help, and it was raced by Penske. So the 919 engine was a 2-liter, single-turbocharged V4 engine, made around 500 horsepower, ran to 9,000 RPM. Had a 7-speed sequential transmission, which was mounted to the rear axle. It was actually a super long transmission. They say it ran almost a third the length of the car because of how short the V4 engine was. So that's kind of wild. Porsche's approach to the hybrid system was different. They utilized a separate system each for the front and for the rear. The front system used an MGU motor generator unit to extract electricity from regenerative braking, and also acted as a 250 to 400 horsepower electric motor for the front axle, depending on which hybrid category the car was set up for. On the rear, they actually put a second turbine in the exhaust along with their conventional turbo. So the second turbine drove an electric motor. In this way, the car was actually unique in this class for being able to charge its hybrid system whenever the car was running. As far as their actual hybrid power supplier, they used a lithium-ion battery pack, which was supplied to them exclusively by the company A123. Audi had just won the 2014 24 Hours of Le Mans, which, as I said before, was their 13th overall victory since entering in 1999. So Audi, Le Mans, it was, if you're a Formula One fan right now with the way that Mercedes has been dominating Formula One, I mean, double that. And that's Audi's domination of the 24 Hours of Le Mans. They'd scored victories with the R8, the R10 TDI, which was their first diesel Le Mans challenger, the R15 TDI, and their current car, which is the R18 TDI e-tron Quattro. By 2015, Audi was in their 10th season of running a diesel LMP, and I mean, at this point, they had gotten pretty good at it. The heart of the R18 was a 4-liter single-turbo V6 making 558 horsepower. It was what they call a hot valley design, which is that the exhaust exited in the center of the engine's V, not on the outside, as you usually see in conventional engines. The turbo, which was made by Garrett, featured variable turbine geometry to cut down on turbo lag. Audi had actually also experimented with a second turbine like Porsche had done for their hybrid system, but they decided against using it. Red line on the engine was 5,000 RPM, which actually makes it a pretty high revving engine for a diesel. Incidentally, the R18 was a super quiet race car. It's one of those things, if you drive it in a racing sim or something like that, you have to turn the volume way up to hear your shift points. It is almost concerningly quiet. So for 2015, Audi had increased their hybrid output from 2 megajoules to 4 megajoules. Hybrid output was linked in the WEC to fuel usage, so you could have as much as 8 megajoules, but your engine had to use significantly less fuel per lap. There were also modifiers for gas versus diesel engines and that sort of thing. Anyway, Audi's hybrid system was a flywheel system like Nissan's, except not really in any way like Nissan's. Audi uses a single carbon fiber flywheel, which spins at 40,000 RPM, and when engaged, it drives an MGU, motor generator, to supply power to the front wheels. So here we go, we have four cars, four totally different engines, four totally different hybrid systems operating at each of the four different power levels allowed by the WEC for their hybrid systems, but only one with a radically different chassis configuration. So how did it go? Well, Porsche would take the top three spots in qualifying. The fastest lap's a 3:16.887. Audi would take the next three spots, running times between 3:19 and 3:21. Then came Toyota, running in the 3:23s, followed by Privateer Rebellion Racing, ran a 3:26 and a 3:31. Team Bicoles ran a 3:36, which finally brings us to our first Nissan, the 22 car, running a 3:36.995. The other two Nissans ran a 3:37 and 3:38, but were split by the leading LMP2 car. So the fastest Nissan was 20 seconds off the pace, the slowest 22 seconds off. This left them at over 110% of the lead car's time, so they had to start from the back of the prototype grid. Honestly, the race really didn't go a whole lot better for them. The 21 car, which I think is awesome looking, was painted in a retro Nissan red, white, and blue livery, retired on lap 115 with a broken suspension. The 23 car, which was painted red, failed on lap 234 with a gearbox issue. The 22 car, also red, was actually running at the end of the race, but was not classified because it only completed 242 laps over 24 hours. For reference, the winning Porsche 919 ran 395 laps. If the 22 hadn't been a victim of an accident that removed most of its front bodywork and radiator earlier in the race, it may well have completed the 276 laps it would have needed for classification. A small victory existed in that the car was actually lapping faster at the end of the race than it did in qualifying. So I guess by that point, Nissan had gotten a little bit better handle on the car, so it was flying around there, relatively. There were, to my mind, two bright spots for Nissan during the race. First, they were faster than all but one LMP2 car despite a power and weight disadvantage. Wait, a power disadvantage? Yeah.
Nissan actually ran Le Mans without their hybrid system functioning at all. It was a particularly heavy system, so it was simply ballast in the car, adding nothing but weight. Nissan's 1,200 horsepower Monster races a 500 horsepower shell of itself. Secondly, the problems with the GTR LM Nismo faced were, they're kind of the sort of the problems you would expect to see in a car that had really only been developed for 8 months. Porsche had been working on the 919 for over 2 years by the time it debuted. Same with Toyota with the TS030. In about one-third that time, with a team of under 100 people, totally new and alien concept, Nissan got three cars to the track and had new car problems, the sort of thing you'd find during 2 years of development. Suspension issues, gearbox, brake problems, all things that probably would have been improved upon with development. I say would have been, because shortly after Le Mans, Nissan had seen enough. On December 22, 2015, Nissan officially canceled the program. In short, the company decided the car wasn't going to compete for victory, so they ended it. I do wonder if this was due to them not wanting to work with the car to get to that level, or if they thought they knew where they could develop the car to, and that simply wasn't going to be enough. My theory is that it's actually the second. Considering the hybrid power systems, Nissan was classified as a 2 megajoule system, meaning they would only look to gain a second a lap from it. Half a second per megajoule is apparently what they shoot for. Even with a lighter and fully functional hybrid system, that wasn't going to eat a ton into their 20-second gap. A 2016 car was in the works when the problem was killed. Unfortunately, we never got to see it. So, this doesn't really count for anything, but just for fun, I took the GTR LM Nismo for a few laps in Gran Turismo Sport. Full disclosure, I don't play a lot of Gran Turismo Sport. I'm only at about level 6. And honestly, the game feels kind of arcadey to me compared to something like an Assetto Corsa. But it is the only one that has the car in it, and Nissan and Gran Turismo kind of have close ties together, so I was hoping maybe Gran Turismo knew something about the car when they were putting it in there. I'm also only a low enough level that there's literally no tracks in the game that, you know, I can't race Le Mans, so I took it to Scuba, which is a pretty bad match for the car because it's kind of a short, winding kind of track. But it really didn't drive that bad. It was stable, it was easy to drive because of the front-wheel drive, but it never let me forget that it was front-wheel drive when it was accelerating out of turns. Which, I mean, you know, it's a 600-horsepower front-wheel drive car, so it's kind of like, you know, what do you want? GT Sport also, it doesn't seem to model the hybrid as rear drive, because I never really felt anything other than front drive, so I suppose that's realistic. But the game also gives no sort of indication when the hybrid system might be active, so, you know, who knows. I don't think the world properly appreciated the GTR LM when it showed up. Most people panned Nissan for their approach, which is weird in a field where innovation is everything. A swing and a miss here is still something tried and something learned. Maybe an unpopular opinion, but I feel like the Nissan GTR LM Nismo is everything right in motorsports. In a world that had basically sussed out the ideal setup for a race car, Nissan said, "No, thank you, we'll try doing something else." It would have been simple for a company like Nissan to build a competitive car that was designed exactly like its competitors, but Nissan looked at the rules and thought they'd found a better way. No matter how it worked out, that's the spirit behind great racing cars. So guys, that's pretty much the story of the Nissan GTR LM Nismo. It's weird that I really didn't think much of the car, but in researching it and looking at what Nissan was trying to do, I actually think that they had a pretty good idea, and I'm more than a little bit miffed that it didn't go any further than it did with all the work that Nissan and Nismo and Ben Bowlby put into it, that Nissan canned it after the one race. I mean, I would have liked to have seen it compete again, you know, maybe the 2016 further developed car. I don't know. It's just, I like seeing things happen that, you know, it's not necessarily what you would expect. So that does it for the Nissan GTR LM Nismo. I haven't actually decided on what car I'm going to be doing next. But I don't know, maybe I'll announce it on Twitter or something like that. So anyways, if you got this far, thank you very much for listening to the podcast. I appreciate it. And again, you know, if you guys have any constructive criticism, or if you want to shoot me a DM on Twitter, get me at racecarpodcast. You can shoot me an email, racecarpodcast@gmail.com. And, you know, if you have a suggestion for a car to talk about, I'd love that. So thanks, guys. Thanks for listening. Have a good one.